Tonight we have poet, novelist, playwright, and teacher and feminist Sally Bingham reading for us. She is the author of so many books it would take me a few minutes to list them all. She has written in nearly every genre there is, from her famous memoir, Passion and Prejudice, to collections of poetry. Of her newest collection of short stories, Red Card, has been said, "These engaging tales span landscape, gender, and age, and readers will treasure Bingham's strikingly perceptive composition and refined, clever flashes of detail and clarity. Restrained and wise, these lovely stories unfold like lavender-scented linens, quieting the fretful mind." Of her poems, it's been said that they forge the light and darkness to shape a body of work that engages and shines. The past and the present, the inner and the outer, are all drawn precisely with small wisdom lines throughout. And as I was looking for things to tell you about Sally tonight, I found an interview where she was asked why she wrote in so many different genres, and I thought her answer was very simple and good advice for all of us. She said, "It takes some gall. But sometimes you just have to be confined, sometimes you just cannot be confined to one form." And here's something else. "I know now that less is more. I used to try to plant, explain, elaborate on my characters as though the reader wouldn't understand otherwise. Now it seems to me a single detail, perfectly chosen, stands for paragraphs of description." Let's hear it for poet, playwright, author, feminist, and teacher Sally Bingham.
Well, I promise you there won't be any lavender-scented linen tonight. Not really fond of that comparison. I'm going to read tonight from two of my collections of short stories, the most recent one, which is this one, Red Car, and then the one that was published a few years before that, which is called Transgressions. These are both published by Saraband Books. Some of you may know that really excellent small press that publishes largely poetry and short stories. And if anyone can't hear, it seems to me this is booming, but if anyone can't hear, be sure to let me know. So I'm going to start with a story from Transgressions. And I think all writers transgress, maybe just by the mere fact of putting words on paper. After all, it's a demand for attention that maybe is in itself fairly transgressive. But also the various acts of transgression, both against other people and probably in a more interesting way against ourselves, those acts that are sometimes called kindness, generosity, empathy, and so forth. Those have always been my meat from when I first began writing, now almost 40 years ago. So this story is called Apricots. That June, Carolyn's apricot tree finally bore fruit. In the 6 years she'd lived in the house behind the tree, late frost had nipped its buds in April, and only a few dwarfed apricots had hung on the branches. Neighbors said the apricot trees were not native to New Mexico, but were brought as seedlings in the saddlebags of the conquistadors. Over the centuries, they had not adapted to the harsh climate, but neither had they died. All along Carolyn's dirt road, the tall conical shapes stood out in winter, and in a rare spring were thickly hung with white blossoms and bees. Living alone after a lifetime of living with other people granted Carolyn time and leisure that had mystified and depressed her at first. Where were the faces that used to surround her kitchen table? Where were the feet that had pounded on her stairs? But lately the time had seemed the only real luxury life had ever could or ever would offer to her. To lie in bed late, dozing until the sun slid into her window and across her bed, a blade of hot brass. To eat alone off a tray in this or that corner of the house or garden. To fall asleep sometimes on the porch while a summer storm rattled overhead, then gave way to stars and the pondering moon. To Carolyn, at 63, it seemed all the nature that surrounded her sustained her. The moon and its silver cycles, the pink-red geraniums, and the long flowing native grasses in her garden. And now the apricot tree, itself, with its bridal finery that didn't droop and was replaced overnight, it seemed, with an astonishing crop. All pondered, all watched from within their private and separate existences. At first, she picked all the apricots she could find and filled bowls and baskets where the fruit fermented, giving off a sweet perfume that reminded her of the candy shops of her childhood. She hated to throw out all that luxury, that unprecedented generosity, but at first she could not think of an alternative. For a few days, she let the fruit drop from the tree and ground it under the tires of her car every time she went in and out, but that was an unacceptable waste. Finally, she remembered another scene from her childhood of women sweating, chatting, bending over pots on a stove, and she decided to do some canning. For a city woman, the idea of spending a day in a hot, steamy kitchen was at first unthinkable, but she remembered all the friends who would prize squat jars of apricot jam and how a few of those jars would blaze on her pantry shelves in the depths of winter. And so she went out and bought 4 large, light aluminum pots, bigger than any pot she had ever owned, and after some searching discovered that the cardboard trays of quilted jam glasses she remembered were still available, along with the white oblongs of paraffin needed to seal the tops. But the task was daunting, and Carolyn soon realized she would have to have some help. The steps in her mother's cookbook were complicated, and especially the dry insistence on blanching the fruit to remove the skins, then processing them to prevent darkening. Carolyn was not sure why the fruit should not darken, since she could not remember anyone in the old days caring whether it was dark or not. She pondered the situation for several days, meanwhile accumulating more bowls and baskets of apricots. Going out early in the morning to pick up what had fallen during the night, she would stop for a moment and stand with her hands on her hips, looking at the huge glittering thunderheads that already piled up in the west. Then she would bend to her task, feeling for a moment not like a sophisticated older woman released at last from unproductive demands, but like a nymph let loose in a glade. Her yard and drive were not equal to that picture, but she herself was, she believed. Then it occurred to her that one of the young men in the class she taught at the local college might be willing to help. The class had not been a particular success from Carolyn's point of view. The students were listless, and her attempt to interest them in the poetry of the modernists largely failed. But there was one among them who seemed to have a spark of willingness. Sometimes she caught young Charles Cooper's eyes fixed upon her as she lectured. The semester ended shortly, and when she met with her students to hand them their graded finals and speak, she hoped, a few words of wisdom about the importance of E.E. Cummings and H.D., Carolyn had made up her mind. As the little group gathered itself to leave, she signaled to Charles, who as usual was watching. He came to her desk promptly. "I have a job I want to do. A domestic job," she added. "My apricot tree is covered with fruit, and I want to put up some jam." He looked at her alertly. He was a slight, sharp-faced young man with brownish hair brushed straight back and oddly freckled green eyes. His hands and feet, she had already noticed, were small, but his legs were long, and his arms, below the short sleeves of his shirt, were tanned and supple. "Okay," he said, a little too quickly, she thought. "Of course," she said, "I'm planning to pay you." "That won't be necessary," he said, turning away. She had to call him back to explain that she needed a morning later that week and to give him her address. As he listened, she felt a little sheepish. The day arrived with thunderheads, brilliant sun, and heat. She filled the largest kettle and set it on the stove to boil water for the jam jars. As she took the jars off their tray, she felt their quilted sides and looked with admiration at the anonymous fruit that decorated their lids. The jars, which normally she would never have noticed, seemed like masterpieces of artistry to her. Who could have devised the quilted pattern of the glass or left such a cunning space on one side for a label? Presently, she heard a light knock and went to let in Charles. She was struck by the fact that he came to the front door rather than to the more accessible kitchen door. "That apricot tree is covered," he said. "Well, I've picked about all we can manage today," she said, gesturing towards the bowls. Charles put out his hand and picked up an apricot, which he slipped whole into his mouth. Smiling, he said, "That's the first one of those I've ever eaten. It's good." They set to the task at once. Later, Carolyn wondered if she should have offered him something first, coffee or a glass of water. She knew young men usually jumped out of bed and ran out with no breakfast to whatever the day offered. She had raised three sons herself and remembered their mixture of lassitude and spontaneity, which had so baffled her at the time. Charles, she assumed, was hungry, but when later on she asked him, he said he had already cooked and eaten a perfectly adequate breakfast. They quickly sorted out the tasks, working side by side at the counter as smoothly, Carolyn thought, as though they had been working together for years. She undertook the blanching, dropping the apricots by handfuls into boiling water, then quickly lifting them out. Drained, the apricots went to Charles, who shucked off their skins. "Do you really think darkening is a problem?" Carolyn asked him as she studied the dog-eared cookbook. "They do look better light," he said with authority. He began dropping the peeled apricots into a solution of salt, vinegar, and water, and the piercing smell of the vinegar was added to the apricot's sweetness. "Oh dear, I'm afraid I should have reheated them first," Carolyn said after she had read the recipe again, but Charles reassured her that the fruit was still hot. Carolyn stopped for a moment to watch him. His small, tanned hands moved regularly across the counter as he shucked the apricots and dropped them into the solution. He was frowning with concentration, lost in the task, she thought, until he asked roughly, "What are you looking at?" "You? I never thought I'd see any of you young men in my kitchen." "Why not?" he asked. "I only know you in terms of my class," she said. "I used to help my mother a lot," he explained. "I expect she's about my age," Carolyn said. "I don't know. How old are you?" 63, she said proudly. She'd never stooped to lying about her age. "Why did you never bother to get to know any of us?" he asked abruptly. Carolyn was startled. It had not occurred to her that anything she had done or not done in the class had had a consequence. "You never even learned our names," Charles went on. "Last week you called Todd Franklin Frank." "I always mix up those names that could be first or last," she equivocated. Really, he had embarrassed her, and she wished suddenly that he would leave. "That's not the reason you called him Frank," Charles said. "You just didn't care enough to figure us out." Carolyn stopped what she was doing and leaned on her hands. Looking down, she saw the age spots rise from her skin like the spots on the back of a toad. She saw the little sacks of skin around her knuckles and wondered when they had come there. "I did the best I could," she said, and knew instantly that it wasn't true. "Taste one of these," Charles said, and he handed her a peeled apricot. Without its fuzzy skin, the apricot looked small and vulnerable, like a naked part of a person that would ordinarily be hidden. Carolyn slipped it into her mouth and brought her teeth down lightly. The soft, meaty flesh of the apricot fell away onto her tongue. It was deliciously sweet and hot. "You have one too," she said. Charles slid an apricot into his mouth and smiled at her. "I forgive you," he said. Instantly, she was angry. "For what?" "Not caring," he said. "Do all your other teachers care?" she asked. "Some do, some don't, but I always find a way to tell the ones who don't." "For their own good," he added mischievously. "I could tell you were disappointed in the class. You ought to know why it didn't work." "I thought it was the reading list," she said. "There's nothing wrong with those writers." To prove his point, he quoted one of them, but Carolyn could not identify the line. "I'm sorry," she said. Charles seemed satisfied. "Let's save some of these to eat later." Later, she and Charles sat on the doorstep and ate them. One by one, they fed the apricots into their mouths. At some point, without a word, Charles pushed an apricot into her mouth, and Carolyn laughed with surprise. "Why did you do that?" "Just to see," he said. They finished the apricots and went back into the kitchen. Charles fished the hot jars out of the sterilizer and pulled up the rack, and Carolyn inserted the remaining jars. As Charles lowered them into the boiling water, a plume of steam obscured his face. Then he slapped on the lid. "So masterful," Carolyn said, laughing. In the back of her mind, a sort of clock was ticking, telling off the details of the plan she had made for the afternoon, a visit to the post office to mail her sister's birthday present, some cleaning to pick up. The clock ticked and ticked, but it seemed to have removed itself to some other part of the house. Charles laid his hand on the counter. "I think you're very attractive," he said. "Oh, honestly, I'm old enough to be..." "Why do you keep harping on your age?" he asked. "Because it's the truth, or part of it," she said uneasily. His hand slid up her arm to her shoulder, bare under the strap of her dress. "You have an amazing body." She was speechless. The feel of his palm on her bare shoulder reminded her of the texture of her own skin, which she treated now like a commodity, washing and drying it mechanically. She tried to remember other touches, other times, but it seemed that the years before had blotted out the memory. She flushed and breathed deeply, trying to regain her balance. "What are you doing, Charles?" she asked. His hand moved from her shoulder to her waist as he turned her. "Kissing you," he said, and did. Later, Carolyn remembered the flesh of the apricots, their slight graininess, the moisture that was not dripping like the sweetness of peaches, but absorbed, contained. She remembered the woolly feel of the apricot skins and the smooth, shining brown pits. She even remembered the seam that ran up one side of each pit, and she remembered the way the thick, sweet smell of the cooking apricots had been cut by the tang of vinegar. And she longed to know what the apricots had meant and continued to mean, even as she realized with dismay that her life was falling apart. The ticking of the clock had stopped and might never start again. With equal dismay and exhilaration, she remembered some lines from one of the poets she had tried so unsuccessfully to teach her class that spring. "That is why I am afraid. I look at you, I think of your song, I see the long trail of your coming." That was said by an old poet of a young poet. Could it not also be said by an old woman of a young man? Thank you. Now, that story's full of a lot of detail. I sometimes think a little too much. One of the things I've done is I've moved on into this newest collection called Red Car, is to move towards abstraction. And it's something I've learned from reading and writing poetry, which is to try to eliminate as much as possible and still manage to get the meaning across. So this is the title story, and it's a short one. It's called Red Car. Car may not be the word. Automobile is long outdated, and car seems to be going, or to have already gone, the same way, although it is perhaps still appropriate for this particular vehicle, a red 65 Pontiac convertible with a front seat wider than a porch swing, a cumbersome white top, and the makings of history in its various grills, bumpers, fins, and chrome ornaments. To tell the story of this car is to tell the story of marriage. Not their marriage, not the marriage, but marriage as it generally happens. A state, a place, a condition that gives rise to certain thoughts and attitudes, certain conclusions. Marriage equals the red car. March. The red car has been parked for a year in front of a pretty frame house in Florida. It sits at the curb like a claim, loud and clear, to the pretty frame house, an exclamation point in that quiet neighborhood. The wife rode in the car for the last time in March. She had eaten dinner with her husband in the restaurant they visited on the way back from the airport, on the way to the airport, and often in between, a lively little place with a bar overlooking the ocean. They both dreaded going back to the house. There's a silence particular to the end of a marriage when there are no words, not even any actions, to convey the despair, the listlessness of the approaching end, and the broad white bed in the big bedroom is no longer even a hope or a possibility, but another item on an endless list of disappointments and regrets. So when he said, "Shall we take a ride?" she thought it was a good idea to put off that end. They drove out along the bay, where the houseboats are snubbed up against the highway, and the lights from the strip developments waver in the oily darkness. He pulled her in under his arm and drove with his left hand, and she wondered why once again she was allowing him to drive her when he was drunk, and why once again their past seemed to have returned. The one-handed driver, the broad seat, the woman shivering in a light cotton dress under the heavy arm of a man to whom she appears, against all reason, to belong. They stopped to look out over the water for a while, as a few months later they would stop in an overgrown field to look for the last time at a pair of circling hawks. The power that held them in the palm of its hand arranged these last times carefully. The beautiful golden field leading to massed sycamores at the edge of the creek, the beautiful expanse of the Atlantic at the edge of the built-up town. Last times have a certain weight, a smallness and density. They stay in memory like pebbles in the bottom of a child's pail. Driving back, she remembered the way the red car had come into their lives. A son, turning 16, bought it for $500. The car barely moved, but the body was beautiful, and the design recalled a vanished, elegant life. The son spent a desultory summer poking around under the hood with the help of a wisecracking handyman who knew something about motors. But the process was slow, and before long the handyman had taken over. He knew what to do, and he worked in the cool early morning before the young owner was stirring. So by the end of the summer, the car was running, but it no longer belonged to the boy who had paid $500 for it. It belonged to the handyman's master, who had paid for parts and labor, and who now had the car repainted a brilliant carmine red. The boy did not protest when his stepfather took the car. After all, he had paid for the parts and the labor. The handyman drove the car down to Florida that winter and parked it in front of the pre-frame house. As the marriage began to slide, the family seldom went to Florida. The trip was expensive in more ways than one, and no one hoped any longer to be able to enjoy spending time together. A few incidents had ended all expectation of that, substituting a brittle atmosphere where no one laughed or cried. So the red car gathered dust and leaves outside of the pretty frame house. Passers-by sometimes noticed it and wondered about its history. In June, the handyman's master, the husband and stepfather of the family, began to come down to Florida alone. He enjoyed driving the red car to restaurants, and when he met people there, he drove the car to their apartments. He liked to drive the car that had been his stepson's, but not really, and in which his wife had sat silent under the weight of his arm, to little spots in Old Town, little apartments above bars, respites and hideaways, where the young women who worked the bars and restaurants lived with their clutter of makeup bottles, their fleets of sandals, their blue jeans patched and faded, their collections of T-shirts, and here and there a snapshot of a mother back home in Indiana. Soon, one of these young women laid claim to the red car. She had been taken to restaurants in it, and she had put her comb in the glove compartment and her feet up on the seat as she curled in under the driver's arm. She felt sorry for him, another 40-ish married man who groaned when she stroked him, and she liked the car, and so one Sunday night when she drove him to the airport, she asked for the keys, and he gave them to her. Now she drove herself to work, parking the red car outside the clothing store where she was about to become assistant manager. It was hardly fitting for an assistant manager of a store that had outlets in Miami and Fort Lauderdale to come and go on a battered Schwinn. After that, the husband let the girl know which flight to meet on Fridays, and she was always there, freshly showered, in a clean T-shirt and shorts. It seemed a paradise to both of them, the pretty frame house paid for by the wife who never came to Florida anymore, the pretty red car which everyone noticed and admired, and which had belonged to the stepson, but not really, and the picture they made in it, the handsome 40-ish husband and the girl who was assistant manager and knew her worst days were over. The car seemed to lengthen. It seemed to take up more space at the curb. Then one night there was trouble for the husband back east, and two men came down to Florida and began in an unobtrusive way to look for the red car. They were skilled professionals, and no one would have noticed them except their clothes were dark. They did buy themselves last plane out T-shirts, but that did not blunt the edge of strangeness that made people look at them twice. They went first to the pretty frame house. The car was not there, and the young woman, who by now was living in the house, did not appear to be there either. They discovered the car parked in the bushes at the airport. They looked it over carefully and found a comb in the glove compartment. Late one night, they watched the young woman step off the Miami puddle jumper and walk to the red car. She had a little suitcase, which she threw into the back seat, and then she released the chrome hooks that held the top in place, with which the wife, who never came to Florida anymore, had often struggled, and pushed the top back. She pulled the car out of the bushes and started down the highway along the ocean, going at a good pace, and the two professionals drove along behind her. First, she stopped at a large, expensive house and knocked on the front door. A Cuban woman, or so the professionals dubbed her, came out with a small child. All three got in the red car and drove rapidly to a pet store, which, since it was night, was closed. However, someone was waiting inside, behind the bubbling fish tanks and the parrots on swings, and the three went in, emerging a few minutes later. They drove to another pet store on the other side of town and repeated the sequence. Then the young woman took the older woman and her child, if it was her child, the professionals couldn't tell, although she seemed protective of the little boy, holding him by the hand, back to the expensive house. Next, the young woman drove to an old house that was broken up into many small apartments. After she had been inside for a few minutes, a fancy foreign car drove up. The driver hopped out, went inside briefly, and came out again. That was all that happened. Something had been claimed, exchanged, or given away. Certainly the professionals knew money had been involved. But they couldn't find a reason to ask questions. Young women do come and go. The red car, which had belonged to the 16-year-old boy, which had passed through the hands of the wisecracking handyman on its way to the 40-ish husband who was about to become single again, and in which he had driven his wife for the last time, was parked outside of an old house broken up into many apartments, where young women kept their clutter of makeup bottles, their fleets of sandals, their collections of T-shirts, and here and there a snapshot of a woman, of a mother at home in Indiana. Did it all begin with the boy's silence when the car, as was only just, passed out of his hands? Or with the handyman's silence when the car, which he had fixed, passed along to the owner? Or with the silence of the wife when she sat under the weight of her husband's arm? Or is there another silence? The silence of night ocean and south wind, combing the darkness while these sleepers lie under the secret verdict of the future. Thank you.